Taking this thought experiment provided that launching point to go into curved space-time. To think about gravity, it provided hints that real gravity might be associated with a warping of space and time. Because the Einstein rotating this thought experiment reveals a curvature of space. Not a curvature of space-time, but just a curvature of space. Okay? And so what I have here is sort of a write-up on the details of that discussion. So I encourage you at the end of this session, before you go to lunch, to pick this up on your way out and read about it on your own. And if you have questions and so on during the camp, then we can chat about it. Okay. So let's move on to quantum. And so last time, what were we doing last time? So we were talking about zero-point energy. Zero-point energy for this guy. So for a ball rolling around in a bowl like this, there was a zero-point energy. It couldn't just have zero energy. It had to be jiggling around a little bit. And then we talked about some of the implications of that. In particular, we talked about the Casimir effect. So if I have these two plates in a vacuum, remove all the photons, okay, it's pitch black, zero temperature, all that stuff, the plates are not charged, we would expect nothing to happen. But in fact, they attract each other. And we've got that weird factor of minus 1 over 12, right? And what you find is if you use that weird factor of minus 1 over 12, the prediction that it gives for the strength of the force, you get a particular prediction for the strength of the force. And then you measure the strength of the force, and you find that it's exactly that. Okay, so this minus 1 over 12 is in fact correct. Okay, so that weird mathematics is in fact correct. Okay, so anyways, right. So let's look at another manifestation of this zero-point energy. Because zero-point energy, and I'm sort of focusing on this, is and stressing it and emphasizing it, is because zero-point energy is one of the most important facts about our universe that we discovered when we started to understand the quantum nature of the universe. It has really, really deep and profound ramifications for just the nature of the way things are. So let's look at zero-point energy a bit more closely. Okay, so in the context of this ball rolling back and forth in this bowl here. Okay, so if we give that ball some energy, it will oscillate back and forth between, say, an amplitude of vibration of plus A and minus A. The projection on the x-axis just goes back and forth. Okay, so classically, in a Newtonian universe, we know that the energy is related to the amplitude how? What did we have last time? Yeah. Right. So the energy is 1/2 kA squared. So if you're looking at that thing and you're seeing that it's oscillating with an amplitude of, say, you know, half a meter, you plug in half a meter here, multiply by k, et cetera, and you get the energy, the total energy. Okay, so the first question, I guess, or the relevant question here is, what is the minimum? What is the minimum energy? Zero. And that occurs when A is what? Okay. So in a classical universe described by Newton, it's possible for this thing to have zero energy, and that occurs when the amplitude is zero. So there's no vibration, there's no oscillation. It's just sitting there at the bottom of the bowl. Okay, so, but in the quantum world, things are more interesting. Okay, so in the quantum world, let's look at how it is that this doesn't make any sense. In the quantum world, suppose we had A equals zero. Amplitude of vibration was just zero, so it's just sitting there. What is X? What is delta X? So delta X is zero. Not because x is 0. X could be, as long as x is some definite value, and we know for sure x has that definite value, then our uncertainty in its position is just 0. We know that it's definitely 0. So delta x is 0. Okay, so what is the uncertainty in the momentum? what is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle? What does Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tell me about delta P? How is it related to delta X? What am I going to write here? H over 4 pi delta X. So we wrote down the Heisenberg uncertainty principle as delta X times delta P is greater than or equal to H over 4 pi. I take the delta X down here, and I get this. Okay. But if delta X is 0, what is delta P? Okay, so this is just infinite. Okay, so what that means is if, for some reason, if you could magically have it in that sort of state, then it would just sort of instantly jump into motion, spring into motion. Okay, and it would get some random momentum, and it would just leave that location. And it would start like jiggling around. It would sort of kick itself into motion. Okay, and so that tells us that A is not 0. It would then get some amplitude of vibration. So if you start with A equals 0, Heisenberg uncertainty says, well, no, you can't have that. A has to be non-zero. Okay, so in the quantum world, there has to be some kind of motion involved. Okay, so the goal of today is to figure out, or one of the goals is to figure out exactly how much energy is required. What is the minimum energy in a quantum universe? Okay, so let's start with the classical expression for energy. Energy is kinetic plus potential. The kinetic is 1/2 mv squared, which is the same as p squared over 2m, plus okay, so there's a kinetic term and a potential term. Okay, so this is okay. So now what we're going to do is we're going to try to make some sense of what is sort of happening. What we know is that the particle is not on some, at least according to the what's called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, the particle is not on some definite trajectory. It's not as if it's like it's not as if when it has this minimum zero point energy, it's somehow oscillating smoothly back and forth between some definite plus A and minus A. It's doing some weird quantum thing, okay, which we can't describe classically, which we can't wrap our minds around. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to imagine while the particle is doing this weird jiggly thing, whatever it is, we're going to take multiple snapshots. Okay, we're going to measure the position of that particle at different times. Okay, and what we're going to imagine, actually, to be technically correct, we're going to imagine that we have a whole bunch of copies of this system, all in the ground state. Okay. And then what we're going to do is take a snapshot of this system, and we're going to say, you know, where is its position? And then we're going to take a snapshot of this system, and where is its position? And so we're going to find its position in different, we're going to find different position values. Okay. And similarly, we're going to measure momentum at different times, take different snapshots and measure the momentum and so on. Okay, and so, and then we're going to average. We're going to average these quantities. And so what we're looking for is sort of a roughly a time average. So we're going to take many snapshots. And we're going to average over what we see. Okay, so by average, I'm going to use this notation. I'm going to put something that I want to average. I want to, you know, over time by taking these snapshots, I will put that quantity in those angle kind of brackets. Okay, so I want to find the average value of the energy. So that means the average value of the square of the momentum divided by 2m plus 1/2 k times the average value of x squared. Okay, so what we need to do is try to make some sense of what this thing means. Average value of x squared and average value of p squared. Okay, so the way to think about this is we're going to look at these various snapshots. Okay, so here's the x-axis, and there is 0. Okay, and this this ball inside this bowl is doing this weird sort of quantum-y kind of a thing. I take a snapshot, and you know, once I find the ball is over there, another time I find it's over there, and so on and so forth. So maybe the first snapshot it's over there, Second snapshot, it's over there. Third one, it's over there. Fourth one there, and so on and so forth. Okay, and then I average. Okay, suppose I take the average value of the of those position values. What am I going to get? Zero. I'm going to get zero because the bowl is symmetric. Okay, it's equally likely to be on the left as on the right. Okay, so I'll just get zero. Okay, but that's not what this thing is asking for. It's not asking for the average value of x. It's asking for the average value of x squared. Okay, so let's see. So what that means is something like this. This is x squared. Okay, so maybe the first value is this. So I square that value and I put it there. The next value is this. Well, I square that value and it's over there. Next value is this. It's negative. But when I square it, it becomes positive. It's over there. And so on. So I take all those values, square them. They're all positive, so they all lie to the right of 0. And so now when I take the average value of this, it's going to lie somewhere here. It's going to be non-zero. The average value of x squared is not 0. Okay, and that's the thing that I want to stick inside here. Okay, so so let me just say this. The average value of x squared is equal to delta x squared. Okay, so there's, I guess, two ways to think about this. One is, this is, we need some way of precisely defining what we mean by the uncertainty in the position. So when a particle, or when this thing is in some state, and the state that we're interested in is this E0 state, so we're saying it's in this E0 state, we know that its wave function looks something like this. Okay, this is its probability pattern. Looks something like this. Okay, so it's likely to be found near the bottom of the bowl, less and less likely to be found further away from the bottom of the bowl. Okay, and so as we see this particle, as we take various measurements of this particle, we will get some kind of a feel for the spread here. Okay. If we find, like, you know, lots of values way out here, well, that means the spread is large. If we find, you know, values only very near the origin, then we know that the spread is very small. Okay, so by making a measurement of the average value of x squared, we can get a sense of the spread of this probability curve. Okay? And the spread of that probability curve is, by definition, the uncertainty, or uncertainty in the position. Because when the particle is in this state, we don't know exactly where it is. We know it's roughly between here and here. It's highly unlikely to be found out here. It's roughly in this region here. Okay. And so our uncertainty, so when we describe where is the particle, well, we would say the particle is at location 0 plus or minus some uncertainty. And the uncertainty, the plus or minus the uncertainty, is this width over here. Okay, so delta x, that uncertainty, measures sort of the width of this crazy 0-point vibration. Okay? And so we need a precise way of defining this. And it turns out that in quantum mechanics, this is the definition of delta x squared. The uncertainty in x squared is defined to be the average value of x squared. Okay? So that should make some intuitive sense, I hope. Okay? And what we're going to try to do is relate that to something sort of more concrete, which is the size of the amplitude of the oscillation. Okay, so suppose that this particle has this weird kind of 0-point motion near the bottom of the bowl. Okay, so its bowl is jiggling back and forth like this. It's very rarely way out here. It's basically around here. Okay, so this is a rough kind of idea. And so the rough idea is, I'm going to put two points here and say, well, roughly it's between x equals minus a and x equals plus a. And I would say that a then is the size of the system, the size that system occupies. Okay, if the 0-point energy is really large, that means it's going like crazy. Okay, tons of like this random kind of motion. In which case, the size of the system, you would say, is bigger. Okay, the electron or the particle is occupying a bigger space. Okay, if the 0-point energy is very, very small, then it's just sort of sitting there very near x equals 0 all the time, and you would say that the size of the system is small. So a is sort of like the size of our system. Okay, and so clearly, A is basically the same thing as delta x. So delta x squared, we're going to call A squared. the size of our system when it's in this weird zero-point motion, when it has this weird sort of quantum fuzziness. Okay, so that takes care of this guy. What about this guy over here? So this is, we want the average value of p squared. Okay, so similarly, this is our p, and this is p equals 0. Okay, so it's doing this weird sort of thing, and at one instant of time, we measure it, and we find, oh, it's moving to the right. And so its momentum is positive, and it has that magnitude right there. Okay, the next time we measure it, oh, it's moving to the right again. But maybe it's moving faster, so it's over there. Okay, the next time we measure it, we find, oh, it's moving actually to the left, you know, with, say, this much magnitude of momentum, and so on. And so we take a whole bunch of measurements like this, and we average those values. What is the average value of p? 0 again, because it's equally likely to be found moving to the right as to the left. Okay, but again, we're not interested in the average value of p. We're interested in the average value of p squared. Okay, so we take all of these points here, and we square them all. So now this is p squared. All of them are going to be 0 or bigger. And so we get a whole bunch of points like this. And then the average value is over here. Okay, it's non-zero. Okay, so again, for the same reason, as up there, the average value of p squared is by definition what we mean by the uncertainty in p squared. This is true when the average value is 0. The formula is slightly more complicated when the average value is not 0. Okay. And so what is this? What is delta p squared? Think Heisenberg uncertainty. What is delta p according to the Heisenberg uncertainty? Thank you. So greater than or equal to delta p is greater than or equal to h over 4 pi delta x. But we want delta p squared, so we square both sides. Or we square the right-hand side. Okay. So here we have a 1 over delta x squared. But we already know what delta x squared is. It's a squared. Okay. So this is the same as h over 4 pi a squared. Okay? So now we say, now we have an expression for average value of x squared, average value of p squared in terms of a, in terms of the size of this fuzzy system. Okay, now we're going to plug those in to this equation here and see what happens. Okay, so what we get is the expected value of e, we take that p squared divided by 2m. So we just take that thing and divide by 2m. So what are we going to get? We're going to get h squared. What am I going to get? What is that thing squared divided by 2m? H squared over 4 times 4 is 16, times 2 is 32, pi squared. And there's going to be an m. And there's going to, so that's a constant out front. And then there's a 1 over a squared. And then I go 1 half kx squared. So that's plus 1 half k, some constant, times the value of x squared, the average value of x squared, which is just a squared. Okay? So that's good. So it's saying that if I take many, many measurements and I average, and I average over those, I will find that there are two terms contributing to the total energy of that system, of that ball. Okay, and one of those terms is this guy. This is just classical. This is a classical, and it's a potential energy term. Okay? So if this term were not here, and we had only this term, how could we minimize the energy? What is the minimum value of the energy? 0 when the system size A is equal to 0. So classically, to find the minimum energy of the system, well, that's simply A equal to 0. The thing is just sitting at the bottom, doing nothing. Okay. Now, there's a term here that is added to this. This term is extremely important. Okay. First of all, it's purely quantum. It does not exist in Newton's universe. Because it involves H. If in Newton's universe, there is no such thing as Planck's constant. That thing is just simply not present, and all we have is this. Okay? But as soon as we have a non-zero Planck's constant, it doesn't matter what that Planck's constant is, as soon as it's non-zero, this term appears. And it's very different from this term. This is an A squared. This is a 1 over A squared. And this is also a kinetic energy type of term. Okay? Kinetic energy in the sense that where does it come from? It comes from the P squared. P squared over 2m is kinetic energy. And the momentum that we're talking about here is this random kind of weird zero-point motion kind of momentum. Okay, so it's a purely quantum mechanical construct. It exists only because particles are claustrophobic. Okay, in this relationship here, the smaller we make the size of the system here, okay, the larger the uncertainty momentum, the more sort of this random purely quantum mechanical motion it has. And that random, purely quantum mechanical motion is associated with the kinetic energy, and there it is. That's the magnitude of the kinetic energy. It depends upon Planck's constant. Okay. So let's make a graph now of this. So let's plot that as a function of A. So we will think of here the energy. Oh, yeah.
The average,
when
are you supposed to square
the A? Do you want this guy or this guy? This one? Yeah.
Oh. Because in that equation, it's
oh, I see.
4.
Yeah.
It's H divided by 4 pi delta x. Delta x is equal to A squared.
Delta x is equal to a, because delta x all squared is a squared. So delta x is a. So here I just put the a in there. Yeah, delta x is a. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to think of this energy here as a function of the size of the system, as a function of this quantum fuzziness, the size of this quantum, the range of this quantum fuzziness, the size of our system. And we're going to ask, for what value is this energy minimum? For what value of the size of the system is the energy minimum? Okay, so what we need to do is plot that function of A. Okay, so this is energy on the vertical axis, and this is the size of our system on the horizontal axis, and that's 0, 0. Okay, so let's first plot the classical term. The classical term is 1 half to some constant times a squared, so it's a quadratic. So it starts at 0 when a is 0, and it grows quadratically. It goes up like that. Okay, so this is the classical potential energy term, 1 half k a squared. Okay? If that's all that there was to it, if we didn't have this term over here, we would just look at this graph immediately and say, oh, well, the minimum energy occurs here at a equals 0, and we're done. But now there's this additional term, and this additional term is very different. This thing grows as a gets bigger. What does this thing do as a gets bigger? It gets smaller, because it's 1 over a squared. What happens to this term as a gets really, really small? It gets closer and closer to infinity. It just grows bigger and bigger and bigger. So it's like this curve, but the reverse. Okay, so for large values of a, it's small. But as a gets smaller and smaller and smaller, it grows up bigger and bigger and bigger. It just goes off to infinity. Just like this guy goes off to infinity eventually for big enough a. For small enough a, this one, it's this one that goes off to infinity. So this is a purely quantum kinetic energy. And that's the h, well, it's whatever, some constant times 1 over a squared. So 1 over a squared term. Okay? And so the energy here is the sum of those two. So we need to write down the sum of those two. And I know we have colored chalk. Colored chalk would be so nice. Where? A whole box of colored chalk! Okay. So let's add these guys up. So to add two curves, let's pick a point on the a-axis. The value of this curve is that. The value of this curve is that. So we just double that. So we're there. Okay, to add, say, at this point, we take this value of the curve and add it to that value. Okay, so we go up like that. And at this point over here, we take that value of the curve and we add that little bit, and so on. Okay, so you can do the same thing over here and connect the dots. And what you get is a curve that looks like this. Okay. So you'll notice, first of all, for large values of A, okay, so large values of A happen in the classical world. In the classical world, we're talking about a bowl that's this big and this thing is going back and forth. We're talking about this is 1 meter. Okay. So we're way, way out over here. You notice that the actual energy, the yellow curve, almost exactly matches just the classical energy. And there's no difference. But as A gets smaller and smaller and smaller, till this guy becomes of quantum dimensions, like atomic dimensions, then we start noticing that this curve departs from the classical. Okay, and it bends upwards like this. Instead of the minimum occurring at zero, when A is zero, the minimum shifts over to here. The minimum is now here. The minimum occurs not at A equals zero, but at some other some finite value of A, we'll call A zero. Okay, and the energy at A0 is some value which we'll call E0. That's going to be our zero-point energy. Okay? So what we notice is that the size of the system, to minimize the energy, the size of the system is no longer zero. The minimum energy occurs at some non-zero value for the size of the system, and that's this particle doing this weird sort of quantum fuzzy motion. Okay? So what's important is there's this purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy term, which becomes important when the size of the system becomes small, when A becomes small. Then this curve totally dominates. Okay, this curve becomes irrelevant. The classical one becomes irrelevant. The purely quantum mechanical kinetic energy dominates. And it takes this classical curve and it pulls it up to this. Instead of going to zero, it in fact goes to infinity. Okay, a huge qualitative difference. It shifts that zero from there to there, and the energy is now non-zero. Okay, so how do you think we could calculate this A zero and this E zero? Calculus. Okay. All right. So let's actually do that just quickly here. So for those of you who don't know calculus, don't worry, we'll just spend 5 minutes on this. The point is that there clearly is a value of A where that curve is minimum. It clearly exists. And at that value of A is zero, the value of that curve, E zero, is some number, right? Okay, so it clearly exists. If you have calculus as a tool in your little toolkit of doing physics and stuff, you can actually calculate that number. So here's how you do it. So you first solve for A0. How do you do that? Take the derivative and find the turning point. Take the derivative and find where it's 0. Okay, so we've got a curve which looks like this. Okay, what we want to do is the slope. We want to find the slope of the curve at various points. And the point that we're interested in is this one. And the special property of this point is that the slope is zero. Okay, the tangent to the line is horizontal. So what we want to do is calculate the derivative, determine the derivative of that function of A, and set that equal to zero, and then solve for the value of A, which we'll call A zero here. Okay, so let's differentiate. Let's take the derivative of our function of A with respect to A, and we'll set that equal to zero. So what's the derivative of that?
It's linear.
This one's linear, yeah. What is the derivative of this? Okay, so Stefan showed us that the derivative d by dx of say x to the n is what? Okay, so what is the derivative with respect to A of A squared? 2 times what? 2 times A to the 2 minus 1 is 2 times A. What is the derivative with respect to A of 1 over A squared? So 1 over a squared is the same thing as a to the minus 2. So our n is minus 2 here, so we get minus 2 x to the minus 2 minus 1. So it's minus 2 a to the negative 3, or 1 over a cubed. Okay? So let's use that over here. The derivative of that e there, first of all, there's just a constant out front, which is h squared over 32 pi squared, I think, m. Okay, the derivative of 1 over a squared, we figured that out to be negative 2 times 1 over a cubed plus half k a squared. The derivative of that of a squared is 2a, so it's a half k times 2 is just k. A. Okay, and I want to set that equal to 0. So now I have something 1 over a cubed plus something a equals 0. First of all, it should be obvious that there is a value of a for which that's true, because if I adjust the values of a, this is positive and this is negative. So I can adjust the values of a to make the magnitude of this term exactly equal to the magnitude of that term, in which case it cancels. So I'll leave it as an exercise for you to figure out. This is just some trivial algebra. And what you get a, then you get the square of a0 is h over 4 pi square root of mk. Okay? So if we go back to our picture here, we now know what a0 is. How are we going to figure out what e0 is? Yeah?
I don't know if you can do this because it's like quantum and classical fashion or something like that, but considering that the minimum point of the total curve, the total energy curve, is the same as the intersection for the quantum curve and the classical curve, can we just like equate h squared over 32 blah blah over a squared, equate that to a half k a squared and find a zero from there?
That's a very good thought. So what you're saying is those two curves, the two white curves, look totally symmetrical.
Yeah.
About that a zero value. So why don't, instead of doing calculus, why don't we just do some algebra and just find the value of a for which this curve equals this curve.
Yeah.
So in this case, it turns out to actually work. And basically what it means is the zero point energy, half of it comes from kinetic and half of it comes from potential.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly half and half. But in general, that's not the case. Suppose I had, say, that curve and that curve, and I added these guys up, then the minimum would be, well, I don't know, minimum of this one is maybe whatever. Maybe these are not symmetrical. Okay? But so in this case, in fact, it does work. You don't need calculus in this case. But in general, you would use calculus. But that's very good. In fact, that's how physicists think, because not all physicists are super ultra hyper mathematicians. And so lots of their stuff is kind of struggling, because they come across some mathematics that they don't understand, and so they're just trying to, so they try to fudge it. Okay? They try to like make as much progress as they can with the mathematics they do understand. And if they can't make the progress they need to, then they learn some mathematics. Okay, so the value of a0 is this. Okay, so how do I determine e0? Plug it in. So I take that value of a0 and substitute it in for a here. Okay, so I'll let you do that. So e0 is, take that expression for e and substitute for a, put a equal to a0. Okay, and you work out some algebra and you get 1 quarter hf plus 1 quarter hf, where f, if you recall, is 1 over 2 pi square root of k over m. Okay, so in that expression, you have a k, you have k's and m's here. There's an m, there's a k. In the expression for a, 0, you have k's and m's here. So at the end of the day, you're going to get expressions involving k's and m's. They always occur in this combination, root k divided by root m. Okay, if you work out all the numerical factors, it turns out to be a quarter hf plus a quarter hf. Okay, so this is, that would be a half hf. But I've written it separately to emphasize that, as I just said, half of that zero point energy comes from the purely quantum mechanical kinetic,
and half of it comes from the classical potential. Okay, which you might have been able to guess, because just the whole symmetry of the situation, remember we had these two bars. We had kinetic energy, potential energy, the total energy is conserved, and these guys just oscillate up and down. So nature really doesn't distinguish between kinetic and potential, it's just a form of energy. Okay, it just sloshes back and forth between two forms of energy, and everything is symmetric. And it turns out that the zero-point energy, half of it comes from kinetic, half of it potential. Okay, so what have we achieved? Well, we've identified we've actually calculated, just based upon common sense kind of reasoning, we've calculated, actually, in the case of the ball and the bowl, the minimum value of energy is not zero. It's actually 1/2 hf. Okay? And what we didn't calculate is the spacing between the next levels, which is hf. Okay, but if you learn how to do Schrodinger's equation and all that stuff and solve those sorts of equations, you'll find that those are just hf. Okay, so what? Okay, so that's a particle or a ball in a bowl. Or the same thing applies to a mass stuck on the end of a spring. There will be some zero-point vibration, some zero-point motion, some energy associated with that. Okay, well, so what? Who cares? Because in fact, in any real situation of, say, a mass and a spring or a ball and a bowl or whatever, we are so far away from that zero-point energy that it's totally irrelevant to us, right? Okay, well, so what I want to try and do now is show you that this zero-point energy has very, very practical consequences, like right in front of your face. Okay, so we're going to look at how this zero-point energy applies or has consequences for atoms. Okay, so the simplest atom is the hydrogen atom. So we'll look at that one. We understand the hydrogen atom, we understand all atoms, right? Okay, so what I'm going to do is just draw a comparison between the ball in the bowl and the hydrogen atom. Okay, so that the quantum stuff we learned about the ball in the bowl just now, we can just sort of transfer over to give us a quantum or to give us some quantum insights into an electron in an atom. Okay, so the ball in the bowl. Here's the bowl. Like this, and this is the x axis here, and that's zero, and the y axis here was the vertical axis. We can also label that axis as the energy axis, okay, because we know that the energy is proportional to the shape of the bowl, it's proportional to x squared. The energy is proportional to the height. Okay, so we'll just label that axis energy, and we will put in these energy levels. We just found the lowest energy level right now, and that was show this. That was E zero. And it occurs when the amplitude of vibration back and forth is plus or minus A zero. Okay, so when the particle is in that state, the system occupies this kind of size. This is the size of the quantum fuzziness. Okay, and then we also saw there are higher energy levels, and the spacing of all these higher energy levels is just hf, all e. Okay, so the ball and the bowl can basically be at this level, or at this level, or at this level, and so on, classically. Okay, so that's that. Now let's compare this with the hydrogen atom. First of all, I should just write down here, the potential energy in this case is 1/2 kx squared. Okay, so that's that quadratic shape. For a hydrogen atom, so we've got some proton here, and we've got some electron, located, and they're separated by distance r. What is the electrostatic potential energy? Okay, first of all, is it positive or negative?
It depends on the charge.
It's negative, correct?
Yeah, it's attractive, so it's negative. Okay, so as these two particles come closer, they like to come closer together, which is, corresponds to the energy being lower. Okay, so yeah, so it's negative, and it gets more negative as they come closer together. Okay, so it's negative, and there's some constant here. This K is not the same as that K. And it depends upon the two charges. If they both have the charge of the electron, this is plus the electron atom, whatever, plus or minus, right, E squared, divided by R. Or is it R squared? It's R. It's just R. Okay, so that's the potential energy. So let's draw that. So this is, R is just positive values here. And this is the energy E. The potential energy, a curve that looks like this, a curve that looks like minus 1 over R, first of all, it's always below the zero. Okay, and for large R, its value is what? As R goes to infinity, what is minus 1 over R? It's close to zero. Okay, so for large values of R, it's close to zero. But as R becomes smaller, minus 1 over R does what? Negative infinity. Okay, so it goes like that. So the curve looks like that. Okay, so instead of this curve, a quadratic going up, it's just this curve, a curve going down like that. Okay, but we can think of it as so as we increase R, it's just it's going up. In the same way, as we increase the size of the system here, it's going up. Okay, so they are very similar. Okay, and does anyone remember what the ground state energy of a hydrogen atom is? Negative 13.6 electron volts. So from chemistry, you might know that. Okay, so there's some definite value of energy down here. That's the ground state. Okay, and then there are excited states, just like there are excited states here. But these excited states are discrete. Okay, when the electron is bound to the, or when the electron is in the atom, it is bound. It is a bound particle. Okay, it's not like flying out freely to the moon. Okay, it's just sitting there around that nucleus. Okay, it's bound to the nucleus. So its spatial extent, whatever it's doing, some weird quantum motion or whatever, it's bound. It's a bound particle. As soon as we have a bound particle, we have a bound wave. Okay, a bound wave leads to reflections of waves and standing waves, and then only certain allowed standing waves, and that corresponds to discrete energy levels, discrete states. Okay, and so they look something like this. And then they get really, really close to space, infinitely close to space here, a continuum. Okay? Close to approaching a continuum. What happens if the energy is bigger than zero? What does that mean?
They are separated.
They're separated. Okay, so if you give an electron, suppose it's in its ground state here, if you give an electron some energy, if you give an electron 13.6 electron volts, it will jump up to this level, which means it has basically escaped. If you give it any more energy, it will escape with some velocity. Okay? And so now it's free. So up here, the particles are free. The electron is free. And it can have any energy. It's moving at any speed. Okay? But when it's bound, we have these standing waves because of reflections of waves and so on. And we get discrete energy levels. Okay, so that's that. Okay, so corresponding, so this is E0. This is the ground state energy of the hydrogen atom. And corresponding to that energy, the system has a certain size. The atom has a certain size. Okay, so just like here, corresponding to this energy here, E0, we just go on the potential energy curve and say, oh, well, that corresponds to a particle vibrating back and forth, basically, with this amplitude, A0. Okay, now same deal over here. Okay, so what this is saying is that basically the particle is ranging between R equals 0 and R equals this value. It's just doing some weird quantum thing in this space, roughly this size. And that size, what is this A0? What is this A0 called? The atomic, yeah. A famous guy to do with quantum. Bohr, the Bohr radius. Okay, the Bohr radius. So what that Bohr radius means is the atom, when it's in its ground state, the electron is doing some weird quantum fuzzy sort of thing, And, you know, 90% of the time, it's within the Bohr radius, A0. Occasionally, you might find the electron out here, but very unlikely. The bulk of the time is spent within roughly about this kind of radius. So we say that the size of this quantum fuzzy object is A0. And when it has that size, its energy is minus 13.6 eV. Yeah?
Wait. In the interval of the energy, it goes up by like half HF for the heel and then HF every other time. But it's a quadratic, so why does it do that? Why is it going up by a constant number?
So why doesn't it just start at zero? Why doesn't it jump to HF, then 2HF, then 3HF?
No, it's going to half HF, then it's going constant from there on in, right?
Yeah.
Why doesn't it go like, say it starts, well, I guess it has to go to half HF because we just proved that.
Then right.
Why doesn't it quadratically increase?
So it quadratically increases in the case of the particle in the box, right? We showed that the first one was E0, the next one was 4E0, then 9E0, and so on, right? That one goes quadratically.
Yeah.
But that means that, and that happens when the shape of the potential looks like that. If we change the shape of the potential, we will change the details of these quantum levels. And so if you solve Schrodinger's equation with this potential, you will get quadratic. If you solve it with a quadratic potential, you will get linear. I mean, why that's the case is just a property of, you just crank out the mass, and that's what it turns out to be. So I don't think there's any intuitive way to see exactly, at least it's not obvious to me that there's an intuitive way to see that. I guess maybe one thing to say is, this quadratic is the most important potential. Basically, everything is a harmonic oscillator. If I hit this table like this, it's oscillating harmonically. Provided the vibrations are small, everything is a harmonic oscillator. So there's harmonic oscillations, like that smooth sine wave kind of back and forth, that's present, that's ubiquitous, that's everywhere in the universe. Everything is doing that. If the amplitude of vibration gets larger, then it might not be that. You get nonlinear turns and so on. But basically, everything is a harmonic oscillator. Okay, and so this is the most important potential, and then it's the simplest actually. You get these linear; it's just evenly spaced. Yeah.
On the right side. So it means my energy is higher than zero. Okay, it means that the electron is no longer bound to the core, and therefore it can just move freely from the plasma.
It can move freely, but that's not like a... it is a plasma, in the sense that, suppose I had hydrogen atoms, neutral hydrogen atoms, and then I heated them up so that they have some random thermal motion. And then I have these neutral atoms, like this, and they slam into each other because they have thermal energy, bang. That mechanical kinetic energy can be given to the electron and bounce it up to here. And then the electrons can fly out free. And so, then you'll end up, if you heat it up hot enough, you'll end up with a gas of protons and electrons, where they have too much energy to settle down, to be trapped, to be captured by any given nucleus, any given proton. So the proton just doesn't have enough, the attractive force is just enough to hold it in. And then you have something called a plasma. So that's an electrically neutral gas of charged particles, like in the sun. Okay, so focusing here on this zero-point energy, the fact is that there is a minimum energy, and we're going to understand what that means. Okay, so let's think about that. So first, a little bit of history here. And again, I can't actually give you the dates, but some time ago, this guy called Rutherford did a very important experiment. Does anyone know what Rutherford did? Yeah.
He took like a piece of like gold metal or something and shoot like a beam of like a radiation alpha particle or something like that. And based on these results, he predicted that what the structure of an atom might look like.
Right. So let's suppose we have a foil of gold foil,
Okay, and it's made up of atoms like this. Let's just say it's one layer thick. Okay, it's actually many layers thick. And what you do is you fire at these point particles, actually helium nuclei, okay, which are very, very tiny. So they didn't know that. They're just very, very tiny particles. Okay, so you have a beam of these guys, and they're flying here. And you're asking, what is the structure of an atom? Okay, so if you think that whatever an atom is, if you think it's some kind of stuff or whatever which fills sort of uniformly, you've got some, the atom has some mass. You know, is all that mass sort of uniformly distributed? And then it also has some electric charge. Is that electric charge uniformly distributed? Or, you know, that sort of thing. Okay, actually, the charges were thought to be point particles. So you had this plum pudding kind of model or whatever. So the idea that the electrons were like raisins inside this kind of like plum pudding thing, inside this a muffin. Okay, it's a raisin muffin. Okay, and so if you fire a particle at that raisin muffin, then what you'd expect to find is some sort of weak scattering like this. Okay, what you would not expect to find is well, what they actually found was that okay, what you would expect to find is that most of the particles just pass through. They continue on to the right. Okay, that's what you would expect. What you actually find is that some particles go straight back like this. Okay, and so to understand that required that the atom, I don't want to get into all of this stuff, but anyways, the atom can't have its matter sort of uniformly distributed like a muffin. All of that matter needs to be concentrated basically at a point. So it appears as if these essentially point particles are scattering off of heavy point particles. Okay, that was the upshot of it. Anyways, at the end of the day, after Rutherford had done those experiments, people thought about the nature of the atom, and sort of all of classical physics, all of the ideas, all of the structure, all of the way that physicists thought about the universe, how the universe works, and so on, together with Rutherford's results, ended up with people having the following picture of the atom. They said the atom, let's say the hydrogen atom, consists of a very dense core. Okay, 99.9999% of the mass of the atom is located basically at a point at the center, positively charged point at the center. And the electron is this point particle over here, and it is doing something. It is doing something. It is somehow bound to that heavy nucleus. They know that this guy is positively charged and this guy is negatively charged. And so they say, well, the only attractive force that could bind them is electrostatic. How does this force vary with distance? If this is distance r, if I double r, how does the strength of that force change? It goes to 1/4 of it. So the force is proportional to 1/r². Okay? Is there another force in nature that's proportional to 1/r²? Gravity. Okay. So according to this picture here, you can say that this situation is exactly analogous to a heavy object like the sun with another object orbiting around it, with another object attracted with a 1/r² force. And so what does the Earth do? Well, it just orbits around like this. And so the model of the atom, this is sort of the best that physicists could do. The entire history of humanity behind it said, this is what an atom is. So there was a point in history where this is what an atom is. And that was the best people could do. Yeah. Yeah.
So the electron would lose the energy because it emits this energy as a light ray or some other kind of electromagnetic.
That's right, that's right. And that's the problem. Okay? So they got to this point over here and they said exactly what you said. They said Newton tells us this 1/r², tells us these orbits, et cetera, et cetera. Maxwell, so the two great geniuses of pre-Einstein physics, Newton and Maxwell, together, they tell you that this guy needs to radiate electromagnetic radiation. Because remember what I said, the source of all light is what? Moving charge? How is it moving?
accelerated charge. Okay, so a charge at rest is not going to do anything. A charge in uniform motion isn't going to radiate. You have to accelerate it. You have to change its direction of motion or change its speed. Okay, and then it will radiate electromagnetic waves. While this guy, although the speed is not changing if it's a circular orbit, it's definitely experiencing some acceleration. Acceleration toward the center, centripetal acceleration. It's accelerating. It's going to emit electromagnetic radiation. Maxwell also showed us that electromagnetic radiation carries energy. Radio waves, light, all of those things carry energy. Okay? And so as this thing is orbiting around, it's going to be radiating energy. So you can't get something for nothing. Where does that energy come from? The electron's kinetic, well, and potential energy. The electron's total energy drops. If I have the Earth going around the Sun and I remove some of its energy, what's going to happen to its orbit? It's going to drop to a lower orbit. Okay? And a lower orbit. And a lower orbit. Okay? And in fact, it's going to do so smoothly, like continuously. So it's actually going to spiral in. Spiral in like that. Okay? Okay, so the key point is something like this. In a classical universe, the universe described by Newton and Maxwell, the situation emerges that Rutherford's model of the atom, we're going to have this radiation. Okay? And the key thing about classical is, let me sort of make a point of this. The thing about classical, so the logic is important here. So the thing about classical is smaller orbit, means lower energy. So as this electron goes around and around and around, the system is losing energy, so it must be dropping to smaller and smaller orbits. The point about classical is there is no limit to how small the orbit can become. That's important. So no limit on how small. Okay. So if we look at this picture of the potential energy here, there's no limit. So you can imagine the electron here, and then as it's radiating, it's basically rolling down this potential energy hill. And this potential energy hill goes all the way to minus infinity. So it's first in this orbit over here, the potential energy is this. Then it drops to a lower orbit, the potential energy is this. The energy is going down as it drops to lower and lower orbits. Okay, the energy keeps dropping lower and lower and lower. Okay? And the size of the system keeps shrinking, smaller and smaller and smaller. In a classical universe, there's no limit to how small that the system can become. The energy just keeps on going down. There is an infinite amount of energy available here to radiate. And the amount of energy that's radiated is going to just basically grow exponentially as you start this collapse of the atom. Okay, so the weight of all of classical physics up to that Rutherford point said that if what we understand about the universe is true, you know, if we were to suddenly have a switch that we could, you know, click it on and make it true, what would happen is in a split second, every atom in the universe would basically radiate a blinding flash of radiation. And all atoms would collapse into these little, like, inert lumps. And so, you know, in a blinding flash, everything changes. Well, it's not happening, so all of physics is wrong. Right? Something's seriously wrong here. Okay, so the kind of wrongness is bad. Okay, so I should also say there's an infinite amount of energy can be emitted. There's no limit, okay? Whereas in the quantum world, we know this is very different, okay? We know that there is this zero-point energy. Okay, so let's look at that. In the quantum world, we have a situation quite analogous to that one over there that we did with the ball and the bowl. And I'll just draw you the picture, sketch it out here. So what we've got is R like this. There is a classical potential energy term. analogous to the one that grows like 1 over a squared. Here, this one grows like, this is basically negative k e squared over a. Okay, a is basically the size of our system. Okay, if our system is of some size a, the potential energy will be this. So this is r equals a, basically. Okay, and if that was all there was to it, well, then the minimum value of the energy is minus infinity when the size of the atom is zero. Okay? In the quantum universe, however, the smaller you make something, remember that this electron is bound to that proton. Okay? It's not free to just go anywhere. It's bound. As soon as you have something bound, you have bound waves. You have standing waves. You have allowed energies, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? And there's a minimum. Okay? And that minimum basically happens because particles are claustrophobic. Okay? So the smaller you try to make that system, the smaller you try to localize that system. See, as the system gets smaller, you become more and more certain of where the electron is. If the atom's really big, you'll say, well, I don't really know. I know it's somewhere in the atom, but I have like a huge uncertainty. As the atom gets smaller and smaller and smaller with its quantum fuzziness, I know the electron is somewhere in there. I don't know exactly where at any time, but I know it's in there. I'm making myself more and more certain of where it is. As soon as I do that, Heisenberg uncertainty tells me that there's greater uncertainty in momentum, and I get this kinetic energy term. So just like that kinetic energy term there, there is a kinetic energy term like this, which goes to infinity. Okay? I won't write down the mathematical details of it, but anyway, it's qualitatively the same. So if I take this curve now and add it to that curve, the total energy of the atom, if the atom is large, that total energy is basically the classical. Okay, but as I make it smaller and smaller and smaller, I enter the quantum regime, okay, where quantum effects become important, and this curve dominates. And so what it does is it looks like that. Okay, so instead of going simply down to minus infinity, zero size, the minimum occurs here at some value a0, the Bohr radius, and that minimum is the minimum, corresponding minimum energy is no longer minus infinity, but it's minus 13.6 eV. Okay? So it's that zero-point motion which is really, really important. So let me just jot down a couple notes, and then I think we're going to quit. So I always use those erasers. Oh, there it is. Okay. So let's suppose that we start with the electron in a high energy level over here. Okay, so somewhere up here. Remember, these are the energy levels. This is a very messy diagram now, but those are the energy levels. So we start in an excited state. So as photons are emitted, so we're starting with the atom in an excited state. It's going to drop down to lower states. Classically, that corresponds to dropping down to lower and lower orbits. Okay, so as photons, and in that process, it's going to emit photons. So as photons are emitted from an excited state, and so classically, in dropping down and spiraling down to smaller orbits, we emit electromagnetic waves. Quantum mechanically, that corresponds to discrete jumps and discrete emissions of photons. Okay, so all of that's fine. So if we're way out here for a large atom, there's what's happening in the atom is analogous to what's happening over there. Okay, so as photons are emitted from that excited state, basically the atom gets smaller. Okay, and so it can get smaller and smaller and smaller, but then eventually when it gets small enough so the quantum effects become important, then we're on this curve over here, there is in fact a minimum. Okay, so, but there is a limit. There is a limit, and that limit is right here, A0. Okay, if it gets smaller than A0, instead of the energy going still down further and emitting more and more photons, it can't. The energy goes up again. Okay, so it can't get any smaller. So beyond which, energy goes up. Okay, so there's no energy to emit. Okay, so basically, at the end of the day, what we have is the statement that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is a purely quantum mechanical effect, Heisenberg uncertainty principle stabilizes atoms. Okay, so Heisenberg uncertainty principle is necessary for atoms to even exist. So if the universe were not quantum mechanical, no atoms could exist. Okay? That's a pretty serious fact about our universe. And it comes from this Heisenberg uncertainty. It comes from that weird idea. I mean, when we're talking about the double slit here, right? We said, well, electron getting from there to there, well, it can take, basically, in the Copenhagen interpretation, it exists in all possible states. That kind of weirdness is associated with Heisenberg uncertainty. No classical trajectories and all that. All of that quantum weirdness is required for atoms to exist. Okay? So, in other words, an atom is not anything at all like this Bohr model. It's not anything that has any, that you can wrap your mind around classically. It's not anything like an electron orbiting around. It's a purely quantum mechanical, it's purely alien to the way that we think based upon our day-to-day experience. Our day-to-day experience says, you know, Earth going around the sun, electron going around the atom, that kind of stuff. That day-to-day understanding is completely wrong. It's not just a little bit wrong, it's totally wrong. The atom is completely alien to the way we think about our day-to-day world. It's really cool. These things rely fundamentally on the quantum nature of our universe. Okay, let's have some lunch.